But what do we do about someone who does not believe that the Bible is true? If they are skeptics and doubt the validity of the Scriptures, using Scriptures to convince them is not going to work. They just don't believe it. So what we have to do is we have to convince them that the Scriptures are accurate. The Bible is a book of theology, but it also contains other components. It also contains historical stories. It contains discussions about science. So if we want them to believe that the Bible is theologically correct and theologically accurate, one way to do that is to convince them that the Bible is accurate in other ways. Historically accurate, scientifically accurate. And there's a bunch of ways that we can help approach this question of, is the Bible trustworthy? So what we're going to do this afternoon is we're going to approach that question. Can we trust the Scriptures? Are there supports for the scriptural claims and the scriptural stories outside of the Bible? So we could spend a full day, 2 days on these topics, and we're going to try and crunch it down to about 2 hours. We're going to move fairly fast once we get started, okay? This is a PowerPoint. If you want a copy of this PowerPoint, please reach out to me, write your email down or something, and I will give you a copy of that PowerPoint. What I might do is I might put it on my Google Drive and then share it with everybody who gives me their email address, okay? And that way you can download it. The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. You and I see the Bible as the message of God. It is the power. It is the life-giving words of advice and encouragement. But those who are skeptics, it's ridiculous. It's foolishness. Do you really believe in these stories? Yes, I do. I do. Why? What trust do you have in those? Well, let's look into this. There are some who say, I have to see it before I'm going to believe. Thomas is one of those. And Jesus said, Thomas, you believe because you have seen. And that's good, because were there a lot of people of Thomas's time who saw but yet did not believe? Yeah. Generate thousands of people who saw and heard Jesus but still refused to believe. But you and I on this earth will never see Christ unless he comes and brings us home in his return. But if we live the typical lifespan, we're born and we die, we will never see the face of Jesus on this earth. But Jesus says, for those who have not seen but still believe, they're blessed. That is what faith is believing in something that you cannot see. So these are the goals for the next 2 hours. We're going to look at two different areas. We're going to look at archaeology, and we're also going to look at science, and we're going to evaluate the Scriptures using both of those approaches. And what this means is you're probably not going to open up your Bibles a lot, okay? Because the whole point is to equip you with arguments and evidences that are outside of the Scriptures to help support the biblical narrative. We're going to reference some biblical stories and biblical people. You'll see the verses up there, but we're not going to spend a lot of time turning to those passages. So what we're going to do is we're going to begin with archaeology. Archaeology is digging stuff up from the ground, but it's a little more complex than that. It is the physical record of people and places and events from the past. So it deals with the historical validity of the biblical account, but it has nothing to do with the theological truth. And we need to remember that. Is that archaeology can tell you, yes, this city really existed. This person really existed. This story actually happened. But when it comes to the theological teachings of the Bible, that God sent his son to die on the cross, that God has an expectation for us, archaeology does not answer that question. That's outside of the realm. But that's fine. We need to keep science and theology separated, even though we can see that science can help support this. So this last quote, archaeology cannot form your faith, but it can help inform your faith. My faith is not built on the archaeological record, but my faith can be encouraged and strengthened by what I see in this record. So we need to correctly apply this. We cannot expect to find evidence of every single person in archaeology. We can't do that. It is unlikely, if this world lasts 1,000 years, that anyone is going to find any evidence of any of us here on this earth, in this room right now. Because in the scope, oh, sorry. Gotta try harder. This is learning. Think of Abraham. Is Abraham, does he loom large in the theology of the Bible? Absolutely. He is the father of faith. But yet, in the realm of the world, how big of a footprint did you think he left in this, just in the physical world? Hardly any at all. You know, he was a single person who was a Bedouin. He traveled by foot from place to place. He just didn't leave that big of a mark. So it wouldn't be surprising for us to be unable to find any artifacts that says Abraham wrote this or this belonged to Abraham. So just because we lack evidence doesn't mean that that thing is false or didn't actually exist. So the story of Nineveh, how big was Nineveh? It's huge. How long did it take Jonah to walk through it? Huh? 3 days. 3 days' journey. Do you think a city that's that size could be forgotten in history? It was forgotten in history. So this is the quote. This is the man who found Nineveh, and he found it in the 1800s. They didn't even know where this city really was. In fact, there were beginning to be some people who doubted whether or not the biblical Nineveh actually existed. And it is indeed one of the most remarkable facts in history that the records of an empire so renowned for its power and civilization should have been entirely lost, and that the site of a city as eminent for its extent as its splendor should for ages have been a matter of doubt. It is not perhaps less curious that an accidental discovery should have suddenly led us to hope that these records may be recovered and that this site satisfactorily identified. This is the man, Lanyard, who found Nineveh. And he said, it's stunning. We didn't even know where this city was at. And you read the biblical record, you read other records. It's this huge city, and it's just gone. So that's one example of how people began doubting it because they couldn't find it. Another example is the nation of the Hittites. Uriah the Hittite was the husband of Bathsheba. And the biblical record talks about the Hittites. And up until the 1800s, there was absolutely no archaeological evidence whatsoever of the Hittite Empire. And people began saying, here you go, another example that the Bible's wrong. They've made up this story. Then we found the Hittites, and we found that they were a mighty and powerful people at the time that the Bible says that they existed. So many people have tried to bury the Bible based on a lack of archaeology, only to find that the Bible is true. We just hadn't been able to find those things yet. And this is why. Not all historical people left behind archaeological evidence. Not all ancient sites have been surveyed. Not all surveyed sites have been examined. Not all sites have, not all that excavation has been extensive. Sometimes you'll have this city that is 3 miles by 3 miles, and all they do is they dig a hole that's 12 foot by 12 foot, and they just go straight down to the bottom. And they may not have much more an extensive excavation than that, or it could be 100 square acres, and they're only going to look at a couple square acres. They're missing a lot of information. So they may not even, we know that this city here, we found this city, but we're not really going to dig anymore. And not all ancient artifacts found in those excavations have been examined, and not all examined artifacts have been published. So you can see that the amount of available of information gets less and less and less and less. And the only information that's available to us is in that last category, if it's been published. So think of how many things that are out there that have been found that haven't been researched or haven't even been found yet. So this just emphasizes, don't be worried if archaeology hasn't published a name or a story or a city. Just don't be surprised by that. If I were to ask you to write a story that occurs in 1,000 years, I want you to predict a person, a place, an event, and write that story. How accurate do you think you would be in that story? Probably, you might get a name right. You're probably not, because our names have changed a lot. The biblical record is interesting because the Bible talks about names and places and people before the archaeological evidence was found whatsoever. So what the Bible does is it presents hypotheses. If we were thinking about it in science, the Bible says you will find somewhere a city of Nineveh, and in that city you will find evidence of the names of these kings, Sennacherib, Esharadan, and so on. And then it makes those predictions, and then when we find that city, we find the names of those kings. Or it'll say, this is the name of this king, and he went to this city, and he was not able to conquer that city. So that's what the Bible does. Let's look at the Bible as predicting events and people and cities before we found anything in the archaeological record. And that's the test that we're going to apply. Because the Bible, the biblical manuscript, we have that hundreds and thousands of years before we started digging in the ground. Does this approach make sense to you? That when it comes to which came first, the biblical text came before this stuff was dug out of the ground. So what do the manuscripts predict? The names of kings and people, of cities, nations, empires. They describe specific events within those nations or in between nations, and they describe specific geological events. The most challenged parts of the Old Testament deal with the times between the divided kingdom and before. After the captivity, there's generally not a lot of argument about those stories, but before the captivity, especially the kingdom, the united kingdom of Saul, David, and Solomon, and before, there's a lot of, hey, are we really sure that that is accurate? We're going to limit the most of our discussion to archaeology that deals with the divided kingdom and before. So to give you an example of an approach that we're going to take, let's go turn to Acts chapter 12. And you can read this. I've got the quote up there. In Acts chapter 12, we have the death of Herod Agrippa. And we were reading this at Murray Road Wednesday night, which is kind of what got my attention, because Agrippa dies in a spectacular fashion. And here's the quote, starting with verse 21 of Acts 12. Soon on a set day, Herod, arrayed in royal apparel, sat on his throne and gave an oration to them. And the people kept shouting, "The voice of a god and not of a man." Then immediately an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give glory to God, and he was eaten by worms and died. As a child, I have a very specific vision of what this looked like, okay? These worms just come exploding out of him, and then he dies on the spot. That's as a little kid, and I still fight that, probably because it's a cool-looking image, I don't know. But Herod Agrippa was a prominent figure of history back then. So does it stand to reason that there would be a record of how and when he died? Yeah. So I'm like, hey, let's see, what does history say? Josephus is a Jewish historian. He wrote to the Romans about the history of the Jews. He wrote after the times of Christ. Josephus, there's really not a lot of indication that he was a believer in Christ. So for us to find something in his writings that support the scriptures, we can't really consider him someone who's on our side. At best, he's neutral. So this is what Josephus has to say about Agrippa. And I'm going to have to get my old man glasses on. Now when Agrippa had reigned 3 years in all Judea, he came to the city of Caesarea. On the second day, of which he put on a garment made wholly of silver, and of a contexture truly wonderful, and came to the theater city early in the morning, at which time the silver of his garment, being illuminated by the fresh reflection of the sun's rays upon it, shone out after a surprising manner, and was so resplendent as to spread a horror over those who looked intently upon him. And presently his flatterers cried out, one from one place and another from another, that he was a god. And they added, be thou merciful to us, for though all we have hitherto reverenced thee only as a man, yet shall we henceforth own thee as superior to mortal nature. Upon this the king neither rebuked them nor rejected their impious flattery. But as he was presently afterwards looked up, he saw an owl sitting on a certain rope over his head, and immediately understood that this bird was a messenger of ill tidings, as it had once been a messenger of good tidings to him, and he fell into the deepest sorrow. A severe pain also arose in his belly and began in a most violent manner. Accordingly, he was carried into the palace and the room. Okay, and as he said these things, his pain became violent. And accordingly, he was carried into the palace, and the rumor went abroad everywhere that he would certainly die in a little time. Now, as the king rested in a high chamber, and as he saw them below lying prostrate on the ground, he could not himself forbear weeping. And when he had been quite worn out by the pain in his belly for 5 days, he departed his life. It's the same story. So this is what we're looking for, is to see the biblical record supported by something in archaeology. And for me, this just increases my faith in the Scriptures, not just historically, but it also increases my faith in the Scriptures when it comes to the teachings. So these are the kinds of things that we're going to look for in the archaeological record. We're going to look for towns. Which is this picture right here. We're going to look for the buildings, the structures, and the walls. Can we find certain cities in the right places? They look at pottery. They can date pottery and see what time frame that pottery came from. Sometimes broken pottery, they would use those shards as tablets to write on. So you'd find a piece of broken pottery, and on one side of it, you would have someone writing a message or practicing the alphabet or writing their name. We'll also look for these things called bullae or bulla. How would they seal envelopes and stuff 100 years ago? You'd put wax down, hot wax, and they'd seal it with a ring and a signet. A bulla is the same thing. It was a piece of wet clay that they would put an impression on, and that impression would carry the name of the signature. It would say the servant of so-and-so or king so-and-so. So we can look at these little pieces. You and I might look at anything as just a flat piece of mud, but it was not. It actually has writing on it. We'll look at papyri, which are fragments of book pages, and we'll also look at writings that are on stones. So the first thing that we're going to look at, and this we're going to run through a whole bunch of these, the Meshastele or the Moabite stone. It's attributed to the Moabite king Mesha. Mesha is referenced in 2 Kings chapter 3, verse 4. And it says, now Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheep breeder, and he regularly paid the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and wool of 100,000 rams. But it happened when Ahab died that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. So Mesha was the king of Moab. He was a tribute, or he paid tribute to Ahab, king of Israel. Ahab dies, and Mesha says, I'm done. Does anyone know who the father of Ahab was? His name was Omri. Omri was the father of Ahab. So this is what we have here. This is the text of this stone. I am Mesha, son of Chemosh, king of Moab. As for Omri, king of Israel, he humbled Moab for many years, for Chemosh was angry at his land. And his son followed him, and he also said, I will humble Moab. And in my time he spoke, but I have triumphed over him, over his house, while Israel has perished forever. Look at what we have here. We have a king Mesha. His name is mentioned. His kingdom is mentioned. Omri of Israel is mentioned. That Omri has a son who is also king is mentioned. And that Mesha revolted against Israel. all of these things, this single tablet, this single piece of stone mentions all of these things that are found matching the biblical record. The Tel Dan Stela was discovered in 1993 in an excavation in northern Israel. Up until this time, one of the claims that was made is that we have King David, this mighty, mighty kingdom, and this mighty king that's mentioned that is so important to the Israelites, and there's not a single archaeological reference whatsoever to King David. People were beginning to think that David was a false king, kind of like King Arthur. It's just these myths. Then they found this piece of rock, and if you look here in the red, it talks about the king of Israel. And it talk in line 8, also the king of Israel. And then line 9, who is mentioned? The house of David. This is the first time that the house of David or the name David, the Israelite, is mentioned in the archaeological record. So now it silences those critics when it comes to them saying that David is never mentioned in the archaeological record. There are potentially two other times where David's name shows up in the archaeological record. The events that are contained in the underlined section are also found in 2 Kings chapters 9 and 11 regarding the acts of Jehu of Israel. The Kirk Stel contains the events of Assyrian kings Shalmaneser III. And what this does is it lists Ahab of Israel. It talks about cities that he has gone to, and soldiers that he has used as part of this, and it includes 10,000 soldiers of Ahab of Israel. The Moabite stone mentioned that Omri had a son, mentions Omri by name, mentions that Omri has a son, but does not give the name of Omri's son. Here in this piece of stone, we have King Ahab specifically mentioned during the time frame of the Assyrians. The black obelisk of Shalmaneser III. An obelisk is like a stone structure. You know what the Washington Monument looks like in Washington, D.C.? Kind of like that really tall pillar. That's kind of what an obelisk looks like. An obelisk or a prism. It's a really tall stone, and often what they would do is they would write down things on the side of that. Has anyone heard of the Code of Hammurabi? The Code of Hammurabi was written on an obelisk. In that situation, that the law was written in stone, literally, so that people could see what the law was, that the law was unchangeable. But kings would write down on these obelisks, they would create these monuments to record their history and their greatness. And here it talks about, says, the tribute of Jehu, son of Omri, I received from his silver, gold, and a golden bowl. And in this obelisk, it has a picture right here of a man bowing down to King Shalmaneser. This here is supposedly depicting Jehu, who's the king who ruled after Ahab. The Taylor Prism contains the history of the king Sennacherib describing his siege of Jerusalem during the reign of King Hezekiah. And this is what he has to say. As for Hezekiah, the Judite who had submitted to my yoke, I surrounded 46 of his walled towns and conquered them by means of earth ramps and siege engines. 200,150 people of all his rank I brought out as spoil. He himself I shut up in Jerusalem, his royal city, like a bird in a cage. I put watchposts around him and made it impossible for anyone to go out of his city. 2 Kings chapter 18 describes this. And so, who was the king of Judah when the Assyrians came down? It was Hezekiah. And the biblical record talks about how Hezekiah did pay him tribute. He did support him. And at one point, Hezekiah says, I'm not doing this. Then the Assyrians came down and they started attacking towns in Judah. And it does say that the Assyrians surrounded Jerusalem. But what does this record not describe regarding Jerusalem? Yeah, it doesn't describe it being captured or being destroyed. Now, for us, that might, well, what's the big deal? The Assyrians didn't do that. They didn't leave towns and cities behind. They made examples of those towns and cities. They would pile up the heads of the rulers outside the gates of those cities as an example. He never describes the destruction of Jerusalem because it didn't happen. 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 13, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Israel, came up against the fortified cities of Judah and took them. And then it talks about him surrounding it. When Babylon came in and ultimately did destroy Jerusalem, it took many of the Jews in three different waves back to Babylon. In the second wave, we have King Jehoiachin, who went back to Babylon. And you know, we might think, well, what's the big deal of this stone that contains the rations? You know, this is how much food this person got, or this is how much food this person got. Well, look at what we have here. 10 sila to Jehoiachin, king of Judah's son. Just in a random description of things that are being paid out, the mention of a king that had been captured. How long did Jehoiachin live in Babylon? The rest of his life. He remained in prison, and at the end of 2 Chronicles, we're told that he came out of prison, and they clothed him, and they let him sit at the seat of the other kings. All of the other kings of Judah died, except for Jehoiachin. Jehoiachin is in the lineage of Christ as well. So those are some of these tablets or these prisms that we can find. Let's talk about these bulla. These are these things that are these impressions that are made in wet clay that contains the names of things. These are even more fascinating to me because we'll have two names on them. So this one here on the left, belonging to Ahaz, son of Jotham, king of Israel, or king of Judah. So now we have three different things. We have two different names plus a rank and a city, or a rank in a nation. Belonging to Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah. Sheba, servant of Jeroboam. Again, these mention specific kings, sometimes of, king of Judah. Not just that he is a king, here is his name, and this is what he is the king of. When it comes to the kings of Judah, if we are to list out all of the kings of Judah, how many of these do we find referenced by name in the archaeological record? As we get closer to Zedekiah, who was the last king of Judah, they get more and more prominent, but we can see that we have record of a fair amount of them. This is the southern nation, the kings of Judah, that are found in the archaeological record. Sometimes they're found, referenced in stones. Sometimes they're referenced in the records of other nations. Sometimes we find these little bulla, these little round pieces of clay that their names are on. We also have the kings of Israel. We can do the same thing with the kings of Israel. And we can see again as we get further into history, closer to the Assyrian captivity, we find more and more of these kings being mentioned in the archaeological record. Again, in the same manner. But it's not just the kings that we find in the archaeological record. We also find officials. The priest of the high priest, or the servant of the king, or the servant of the priest. And to me, that's fascinating. If someone could turn to 2 Kings, let's do this one here. If someone could turn to Jeremiah chapter 40, verse 5, and read this. Jeremiah chapter 40, verse 5. All right, so we probably just read over those names and like blah, blah, blah. It doesn't really make... But look, it mentions two names, Gedaliah, son of Ahikam. And here we found a bulla, this piece of clay that says Gedaliah, not just the name, but Gedaliah, son of Ahikam. And those are the things that are fascinating to me, that we have archaeological evidence of people that aren't necessarily major officials, that they are servants, that they are priests, that they are they're part of the administration, but yet not only do they show up in archaeology, but their names happen to also find themselves in the scriptures. We have officials from other nations that are both in the Bible as well as found within archaeology. We have from Assyria, from Pharaoh, Persia, from Babylon, the king of Damascus, kings of Persia, all of these are found within the scripture, as well as their names being linked to those same nations within the archaeological record in various ways. And we have part 2, and we have part 3, And the whole point is, you don't have to memorize all of these. The whole point is, there's a lot of information that's out there. There's a lot of evidence where the names of these people were mentioned in the Bible. We read their stories long before we found any evidence in archaeology that they of their existence. And then these are events that the Bible describes that we've also found about in archaeology. We talked about the Mesha stone, the Moabite stone regarding the revolt of Moab against Israel, the fall of Samaria, the defeat of Ashdod, Sennacherib's campaign against Judah, the siege of Lachish, assassination of Sennacherib by his sons, fall of Nineveh, fall of Jerusalem, and the freeing of the captives by Cyrus the Great. This is called the Cyrus Cylinder. It looks like a big barrel that has writing all around it. And in this, he describes how he let the people go, not just the Israelites, but peoples from all nations, go back to their home countries to build their houses of worship again. And when we read in Nehemiah, or in Ezra, we hear of Cyrus releasing the Israelites so that they could go back and to do this very thing. Yes? We had the biblical text for thousands of years before these things were done. That was one of the things I was going to try and do, is list on there when it was dug up and when it was translated, because they're not always the same. It could have been dug up, 100 years before it eventually was translated. Sometimes these bigger things, they pulled out and like, this is really important, we're going to translate it now. But these little bulla, what they find these in Jerusalem by, they're going to build something, and they start digging up the dirt, and they start sifting through that dirt to see if they can find anything that's important before that dirt is taken somewhere else. That's a very long process of building things in Jerusalem. So where does this leave us? At a minimum, at least 9 kings of Israel that are mentioned, at least 9 kings of Judah, 12 other Jewish officials, 25 ancient kings named, 9 specific events, which means there are at least 64 different things from the captivity and back that are mentioned that are found in the archaeological record that support the biblical narrative. So again, it doesn't form our faith, but it helps inform our faith. If someone says, listen, the Bible is just a whole bunch of fables, does this prove or disprove that statement? If someone says it is just full of a bunch of fables, it disproves it. If they say, well, you can trust the New Testament, but the Old Testament, it's just not accurate, it gets it wrong all the time. No, it doesn't get it wrong all the time. And we have individuals have no intention of trying to support the biblical record, finding things that actually do support that. So what about the United Kingdom? The United Kingdom is the time when Saul, David, and Solomon reigned. Do we have any evidence of that kingdom, that singular kingdom, actually existed? The Tel Dan inscription is the first one to refer to David outside of the scriptures. We've had 2 others. There's one that's a wall that has the mention of David on that, and I can't remember the third right now. Most archaeologists will accept that, yes, you had the northern nation of Israel and you had a southern kingdom of Judah, that they were separate, but they don't really think that there's support, or they question the support for both of those nations being united at a single time. So let's look for, can we find events that are described in the scriptures during those days? And can we find any evidence that there was a strong centralized government or authority during this time frame? 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 15. And this is the reason for the labor force which Solomon raised, to build the house of the Lord, his own house, the Milo, the wall of Jerusalem, Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. We have three cities that are mentioned here at the end. Hazor, Megiddo, and Gezer. He says that he built these cities, or he fortified these cities. Is there anything that links these three cities Those pictures there are those three cities. Do they look the same? They do. Each one of these cities has a six-chambered wall gate going into the city. When they date the rocks and the layer of where these rocks are found, it is the same time frame that you would expect for King Solomon to reign, around the 10th of the 9th century BC. So is it absolute proof that scriptural record about Solomon and his activities is true? No, it's not. Does it support that story? Yes, it absolutely does. Because it makes sense. You know, back then, if you're going to build one wall, just keep the same design and the same plan for all of the other walls. So we have this connection between the three cities that are mentioned. In David's time, when they look at the cities that are dated a little earlier than Solomon's time, around the time frame that David supposedly reigned, they find that there are other evidence of a centralized government. That they found a Eltan, which is the biblical Eglon, they found that it was fortified. When you read the Bible, one of the things that kings would do is on the peripheral of their kingdom, they would strengthen the cities on the periphery because those were the first lines of defense if someone was going to attack the nation. So as we get further and further away from Jerusalem and we start seeing these fortresses that are being built, that is an indication of a central government. Does that make sense? Okay, just like the U.S. protects its borders and fortifies its borders because of a strong central government, the same thing is true during David's kingdom. So we have multiple cities that are dated to the days of David that show fortification that are this indication that it is demonstrating a strong central government. And then this next slide is showing something that was found last year in 2021. And to me, this blows my mind. The story of Gideon. What is the first thing that he is recorded to do? When God called him, he did something in the city. He tore down the altar of Baal. He did it at night because he didn't want to do it in the day. The people gave him a nickname. You remember the nickname that they gave Gideon? Jerubbaal. They found a piece of pottery that's dated in the days of the judges that has the name Jerubbaal on it. Well, why is that significant? Wasn't that a common name? No, that was a nickname for Gideon. It was contend. Let Baal contend. Let Baal defend himself. So here you have a name on a piece of pottery that is found, dated to the same time frame as the judges. It's not the site where Gideon lived. It's far enough away. But yet it contains that name, the nickname of the judge of that time. Now again, it's not conclusive proof, but to me what it does say is that name was a real name, okay? That name was being used in the days of the judges. Is it possible that it's Gideon? It's referring to Gideon? Sure, it's possible. Is it possible that it's talking about someone else? Sure. But to me, this is just kind of one of these fascinating kinds of things. All right, so let's talk about the conquest of Canaan as the Israelites went into the Canaan land. And what were the Israelites supposed to do? They went into Canaan. What were they supposed to do to various cities that they came across? Yeah, destroy them and burn them. Just wipe them out to completely eradicate the Canaanites. And so let's look at the highlights of the conquest. So if we go to the book of Joshua and we read through the conquest that's described in the book of Joshua, this is what we find. We find that there are certain cities that should be in certain locations, that certain things happen to them. Jericho was a walled city. What did the Israelites do to Jerusalem? Huh? They marched seven times around, but ultimately, when they left that city, what shape was the city in? It was destroyed. It was burned, in fact. So we have that city was burned. Ai was a very small city that was a short distance away from Jericho, but it was also near the town of Bethel. We have Hazor that was described as the head of all of those kingdoms. The following cities should have evidence of destruction or abandonment about the same time frame. So we can date them, the time of the destruction, using pottery techniques or using radiometric dating. They should all have been destroyed about the same time frame. And Arad, Hamor, Gibeon, Hebron, Debir, and Lachish. So let's look at Jericho. We know the story of Jericho. March seven times around. What was so important about Jericho? It was the first city, but what was it about that city that made it like, oh, we're not taking this city? Yes?
It was very fortified.
All right, it was a fortified. And to us in our modern times, a wall around a home or a wall around a city doesn't seem that very big. But if all you have are horses and chariots and people, a walled city is pretty difficult for you to take down. So this is the first city that they come across. It is a double-walled city, so it meets the biblical narrative. And when they gave the shout, what happened? Okay, what does that mean? The walls collapsed. What direction? They collapsed outwards rather than inward. They collapsed outward. So it's just, they say they destroyed it by fire. Did all of the wall collapse? Huh? Yeah, not around, because Rahab, remember, she lived in the wall. She let the spies down. And they say, you keep this cord here, and this is going to be the indication where we're going to find you. So that house has to have stayed. So this is what we find in the city of Jericho. That the city was destroyed by massive fire with an ash layer several feet thick, that the upper wall collapsed and down the slopes to the lower wall. The walls on the eastern side of the city collapsed before the fire. And how would you know if the walls collapsed before a fire? Yeah, you just look at the layer of ash. One of the principles is that lower layers always occurred before upper layers. So if you have a wall and then you have ash on top of it, you know the wall collapsed before the fire started. Houses were found built into the north lower wall in an area where the wall had not collapsed. They had storage jars and homes that were full of grain. Well, why is that important? The city was not put under siege. It was not surrounded to try and starve out the people. Because if it was surrounded to starve out the people, what would happen to that food? It would have been eaten. And it was also full because it was the time of the harvest. When the Israelites crossed the Jordan River and they came in the time of the harvest is when they came in. They celebrated the Passover right when they crossed over. And the Passover was, there was another feast that was called the Feast of the First Fruits. That's when the harvest started. God didn't do these things haphazard. He brought them into the Canaan land when the land was full of food, ready to be harvested. So we can say that they weren't put under siege, and the city remained abandoned for centuries. Does that support the biblical record? Yes, that supports the biblical record. The findings of this site, I'm not even going to try and pronounce it. Okay, some of these cities were pretty sure of their biblical name, but we don't know because we haven't found any inscriptions that say, this is Ai, or this is Jericho. It just fits the right location, the right geography, the right time frame. So here we have the city of Ai. It's the correct location. And the Israelites call it a small city. Now, when I think of a city, when I think of a small city, I think of like Greenwood. You know, that's kind of what I like, this town. Ai was 3 acres. Okay, my property is 3 acres. If you've been to my house, that is I'm like, hey, this Morris City, come over to Morris City. But that's the size of that city. When they called it the city, it was not just the walls, but it was the land around the city as well. All of that was called the city. But to me, that's why they thought, listen, we don't need a lot of people to take over this place. It's really small. But this, a 3-acre-sized city that has 12-foot-thick walls. Okay, those are some pretty stout walls. And again, they find evidence that this was destroyed by fire. The findings of Hazor, it was called the chief of the nations, meaning that this should be a really, really, really important city. It was densely populated. This one covered 200 acres. Clay tablets identify a king in that city named Jabin. Well, we find Jabin listed as the king in this area in Joshua chapter 11, verse 1. Cuneiform tablets say that it was an administrative center, and it was destroyed also by fire. And all of this supports the biblical narrative, that it was an important city, that it had a king during the days of Joshua whose name was Jabin. So this is what we find that the archaeology supports. The Jericho, Ai, and Hazor were destroyed by fire, the destruction of other cities at the same time frame. But there's a problem for archaeologists, and that's trying to date that and match the dates of these destructions with the dates that Israel came into the promised land. So because sometimes they're off by a couple hundred years, these supposed accepted dates. So there's a couple ways that we can interpret this. One is to rewrite the biblical narrative and say that, okay, it's not quite right historically. We're going to go and rewrite that narrative a little bit. Or accept the possibility that our chronology or our time frame that we have built, that we're off on that, that we need to readjust our chronology and our time frame. So just bear with me a little bit on this. We're going to talk about how do they date things in the past. You ever thought about that when they say that here that this king, so-and-so, King Nebuchadnezzar lived in this time frame? How do they come up with those dates? Well, what we do is we find, if we can find in the records of one nation describing the same event of another nation, and we know the dates of one of those, we know the date of that event, now we can link the history of those two nations. Does that make sense? So that's what they've done. They find these marker points. This event, we absolutely know the time frame of when this event occurred. The destruction of Jerusalem, 586. We know that. So now any record that references the destruction of Jerusalem, we now know exactly how to calculate that. So they come up with these time points that are these marker dates. But if that marker date is off, then it throws everything off. Does that make sense here? Okay, got a lot of glassy-eyed, but we'll go with it. And there's a couple of them that are problematic. One of them is they use this Shoshank, who was a pharaoh of Egypt. They identify him as Shishak, the biblical pharaoh who came up to Jerusalem. If we've identified the wrong pharaoh, then our dating is wrong. And also, they identify that Pharaoh Ramesses II is the pharaoh of the oppression or of the Exodus. And they do that because in Exodus chapter 1, what city is mentioned? Ramesses. They say, well, they worked on Ramesses, so therefore that has to be the name of the pharaoh at that time. Any problems with that? So we could, and another way to kind of put it this way, and I love that, to say that the immigrants came and founded New York City and lived in New York City. New York City was not the name of that area. What was it called? New Amsterdam. That's what, they didn't found New York City, but that's how we refer. So it happens all the time, and if you heard Peter's description, that's great. The biblical record referencing the name, and that may not have been the name of that city at the time. So let's look at the records of Egypt and Exodus. So we think about the Exodus, and what do we find here? It starts, we're trying to date that, so we look at, we're going to skip this part here. These are the things that we're going to look for. We're going to try and find something in the Egyptian record that discusses the Exodus. This is what we're going to look for. That there was a time of great abundance of food, followed by a time of great famine. That there was a rise of a non-Egyptian ruler, that wealth was consolidated into the central government, that there was a dramatic of influx. Semitic people is just like people that aren't Egyptians, people that came from a nation that was not of Egypt, up to the north. that these people abruptly leave the area and that there's events that are indicative of the plagues that we describe that are described in Exodus, as well as a possible collapse of the Egyptian government. Think of what the plagues did to Egypt. What nation, what kingdom could survive all of that? And it would not surprise us if that nation or that kingdom collapsed for a short period of time. So there are three possible pharaohs that have been put forth, and the middle one here is Ramesses II. What you have here are these three pharaohs. You have their names as well as the dates of which they ruled. OC is old chronology, NC is new chronology. And the reason why I put that is you see the one on the left on the Thutmose III and Dutmose II both have the about the same approximate date, 1450 BC. But it depends on which chronology you use determines which ruler was ruling about 1450 BC. So let's look at Ramesses II. Ramesses, is there any evidence that we can eliminate one or more of these options? If Ramesses was the pharaoh of the at the days of the Exodus, did Israel as a nation exist? No, they did not. They were a people, but they were not a nation, if that makes sense. They had not established themselves as a nation in the land of Canaan. There are two archaeological finds that have Israel mentioned in Egyptian hieroglyphs. And the first one here is the Mariphat stele. It was discovered in 1896, and it's written by the immediate successor Ramesses. And it contains a line, Israel is laid waste, his seed is no more. And it's listed alongside of other nations, meaning that he laid waste the nation of Israel, along with the Libyans, the Hittites, and the Syrians. All of these are the nations that are surrounding Israel to the north. So what this tells us is that to the Egyptians, they had now recognized Israel as a nation by the time that this was created, by the time this was written. So the son of Ramesses II already saw Israel established as a nation. And then we have this Berlin pedestal. It, again, it was found in 1913, and it wasn't interpreted or published for years later. It contains name rings of Ashkelon, Canaan, and a damaged ring for Israel. The dating of the hieroglyphs pushes the date of the inscription to the reign of Ramesses or before. Well, ultimately, what this means is that we can exclude Ramesses, that by the time he was the pharaoh, Israel as a nation was already being recognized by the Egyptians. So it's no longer 1250. We have to go back in history. So let's look at Thutmose or Dutmose. When people read the stories of the plagues, they kind of seem fanciful. If you're not a believer, if you're a skeptic, you're like, really? Really water turning to blood? Really hail destroying all of the vegetation? Did that stuff really happen? Well, there's this papyrus that has this writings of called Ipuwer, and the date of his writing is debated. But I want you to, the next slide is going to show on the left-hand side phrases from this writings of Ipuwer compared to phrasings that we find in the Exodus text. And what he describes is bad things have happened to Israel. And he describes, these are all the things that have happened. There's blood everywhere. Lo, the river is blood. Well, what was one of the first plagues? Water turned into blood. One thirsts for water. Why do they thirst for water? Because they can't go to the river to get water, because the water is blood. The trees are felled, the branches are stripped. When the plague of hail came, it stripped all of the leaves and branches off of the trees and destroyed all the crops that were out there. The grain is lacking on all sides. Birds find neither fruit nor herbs. Groaning is throughout all the land, mingled with laments. When they woke up after the last plague, there was a great cry that came out from all of Egypt because of every house had a dead person. Every house had a dead person. In the end, all is ruined. In Exodus 10:7, Exodus is destroyed.